Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very snowy and slick Wednesday morning. This hour of the program, we'll be speaking with Fawaz Yurjis, and he writes to us that he has just returned from the Middle East and witnessed how Israel's assault on Gaza is radicalizing mainstream Muslim opinion. Shown endlessly on Arab and Muslim television stations, the massive killing of civilians is fueling rage against Israel, he writes, and its superpower patron, the United States, among mainstream and moderate voices who previously believed in coexistence with the Jewish state. Now they are questioning their basic assumptions and raising doubts about Israel's future integration into the region. Fawaz is a guest we have fairly often here on the air. He has written extensively about the Middle East and travels there very often. He just returned from a research trip to the Middle East. He holds the Christian Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He is the author of two recently acclaimed books, Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy, and The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global. The Washington Post selected The Far Enemy as one of the best 15 books published in the field, and Journey of the Jihadist was on the best-selling list of Barnes & Noble and Foreign Affairs Magazine for several months. And he's traveled, as we've said, to the Middle East on many occasions. So we will be looking at support for Hamas. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday saying that there are not many protests in Israel, that a number of people in Israel support the Israeli actions. And we'll also be looking at Senator Hillary Clinton's confirmation hearing yesterday, in which she talked about a smart power Middle East strategy. What does that mean? Welcoming phone calls for Fawaz Yurjis, we always do. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you're perfectly welcome to do that. And that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Fawaz Yurjis, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you hear me, Fawaz?
Yeah, I can.
There.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
All right.
Yes, thank you very much for being with
Pleasure.
Us. So you were just there. You were just in the Middle East witnessing, and I'm wondering how you witnessed Israel's assault on Gaza.
Well, I mean, the war on Gaza and the huge loss of life, Catherine. I mean, let's keep in mind, almost 1,000 Palestinians have been killed so far, 1,000, and more than 4,000 injured. At least half of those killed and injured are civilians, particularly children and women. I cannot tell you how the images, the bloodied images of Palestinian children and women. An elderly man are playing on Arab and Muslim television. I mean, I think the extent of anti-Israeli and anti-American sentiments has reached a peak. There's a great deal of anger and rage in the region. And in particular, I'm concerned about mainstream Muslim public opinion. I think mainstream Muslim public opinion is being radicalized. Mainstream public opinion now has joined radical Muslim opinion, believing that the United States and Israel are trying to terrorize the Palestinians into submission.
Mm-hmm. And yet there was an article in yesterday's New York Times, I'm sure you saw, in which they were wondering why there weren't many demonstrations in Israel, where there have been many people who have wondered about Israeli attacks and have criticized them. And this go-around, the article indicated there were very few Israelis who were opposed to what they were doing. How do you measure that?
Catherine, first of all, I'm talking about the responses and the reactions in the Arab and Muslim world and the international community, not in Israel proper. That's an entirely different question. I think what we need to understand is that in the last few years, in particular in the last 10 years, the pro-peace camp in Israel has been decimated. And this is really a tragedy. It's a tragedy for Israel, and it's a tragedy for the Palestinians. Because I think the pro-peace camp in Israel and the region basically holds the key to coexistence, to basically breaking the deadly embrace that exists between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And I think there are several reasons why the peace camp in Israel has been decimated. I think first and foremost, I would argue that some of the actions by Hamas and militant Palestinians have antagonized Israeli public opinion. In particular, I'm talking about suicide bombings. Suicide bombings have done a great deal of damage, not only to the moral case of the Palestinians, but also to the peace camp inside Israel itself. And also Israel, I mean, I think those primitive rocket fired by Hamas has also convinced large segments of Israeli public opinion that somehow, according to the dominant narrative, that those missiles threaten the security and peace of Israel. So really, it's a combination of factors why we are not witnessing large, even though while I was in the Middle East, there were several protests numbering thousands, Catherine, thousands. I'm talking about 4,000 or 5,000Israelis. And, of course, this is a small number. But we were hoping, and we are hoping, that more Israelis would come out and basically demand an immediate end to this crazy offensive, to this really unnecessary war in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the damage that you have seen. Are there a lot of attacks on buildings where there are women and children, where people have said that there are militants, Hamas militants, using civilians as shields, and so those get attacked, and then the Israelis get blamed for that? Or are they just indiscriminately getting buildings where they don't really know if there are women and children?
Catherine, for your listeners, let me just provide a glimpse of what Gaza is. Gaza is one of the most congested areas in the world, the most. You have 1.5 million Palestinians who live in some of the most difficult chronic poverties in the world. Mm-hmm. You're talking highly populated areas. The argument that Hamas basically uses civilian areas. Hamas is part of the population, Catherine. Regardless of what we think of Hamas, Hamas is not an armed militia. Hamas is a social movement. That is, you have almost more than 500,000 Palestinians who basically represent the popular, the social base of Hamas. And secondly, even if Hamas fighters or militants were near the population, does that give Israel, does international law give Israel the right to use some of the most lethal weapons, including American-made tanks and fighter crafts, to bomb those civilian areas? The argument is that somehow there was a UN school whereby hundreds of Palestinian children were hiding in the school, and there were some Hamas militants around the school. Does this give Israel the right to bomb that particular target in order to kill a few militants, and in the process kill more than 30 Palestinian children and injures about 55 children? This is the logic you hear. This is all basically part of the ideological spin played by Israel and its allies in the United States. And sadly, all you have to see is look at the images. Look at the images, by the way. Israel has not allowed international correspondents to go into Gaza. It has, even though the Israeli Supreme Court basically has asked and demanded that the Israeli government allow international journalists, including Israeli journalists, to go into Gaza, it has not done so. And the question is why? Mm-hmm. Because Israel is trying to basically punish not only Hamas, Israel in the same way that it did in 2006 against Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's trying to punish the entire population in Gaza and force it to revolt against Hamas. And what's the result? A huge loss of civilian life and solidarity with Hamas. I would argue when the dust settles on Gaza, Hamas will likely emerge as one of the most powerful organizations, not only in Palestinian territories, but also in the Middle East, as a direct result, of the Israelis' assault on Gaza.
Hmm. There are questions in papers today as to how many Hamas leaders have been eliminated. I guess the question is, Israel, it would seem to me, is pretty intent on wiping out the leadership and would like to wipe out the entire organization. Are they anywhere closer to doing that, or is Hamas getting more supporters as this goes on?
Catherine, again, for your listeners, I mean, I think if you listen to the debate in the United States, I mean, there is a broader debate in Israel about Hamas, as you well know. The argument is that Hamas is an armed militia, that Hamas somehow could be plucked out of Palestinian territories, that Hamas could be wiped out. And this is a very silly, inaccurate argument because, again, regardless of what we think of Hamas, I myself think that the Palestinians deserve better. I think that Hamas is a reactionary movement. I would like the Palestinians to have more of a progressive movement, more an open, liberal movement. But regardless of what we think of Hamas, Hamas, Catherine, is a social movement. And what do I mean by a social movement? I mean it has a viable social base of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Even if Israel, let me go beyond that, it's not eliminate, kill. Even if Israel kills the entire Hamas leadership, let's say Israel succeeds in killing 5,000 Hamas junior and senior leadership, a new generation, more radical than the one that exists today, would likely replace the existing one. Because a social movement has its own dynamics. It can replenish its ranks as a result of losses. And I'm more concerned, not just about the loss, of course, the loss of human life, but Hamas now is not only deeply entrenched in Palestinian territories. Israel's assault on Gaza and Hamas' ability to resist the Israeli assault will likely basically make Hamas not only one of the most powerful political organizations, as I suggested earlier, in Palestinian territories. Hamas now is as popular, if not more so, than Hezbollah or the Party of God in Lebanon. What I'm trying to suggest, what the Israeli establishment and the U.S. establishment, the way they view Hamas is very misleading. They view it in terms as an armed militia. It's not just an armed militia. It's a social movement. Let me put it this way and go beyond that and say the only way for Israel and the U.S. political establishment to wipe out Hamas is to perpetrate a massacre. That means killing 500,000 Palestinians. That's the only way that Israel could wipe out Hamas. This is what they don't tell the American people and the Israeli people.
Mm-hmm. And when you said earlier that you believe the Palestinian do deserve better, what is the better that you're thinking of, and does it exist?
Well, you know, Catherine, look at us here. We're sitting in our safe, wonderful places, offices, and homes, and talking about somehow trying to preach and lecture to the Palestinians. I'm talking about myself here. The Palestinians, I say, deserve better. They deserve a liberal, more inclusive, more tolerant social movement, that basically a more democratic movement instead of a more reactionary and xenophobic movement. But as I suggested to you about Gaza, Gaza is one of the poorest areas in the world, one of the most populated areas in the world. 60% of the population live below the poverty line, unemployment 80%. How do we expect, Catherine, those preachers, intellectuals, and commentators, that the Palestinians would be able to basically bring about a new vision, a new social movement, when the conditions are so dismal? How do you expect the Palestinians basically, in terms of the Palestinians live in a state of siege. There is military occupation. Israel did not leave Gaza, as the dominant narrative in the United States would like us to believe. Yes, they pulled out their forces and the so-called 7,000 settlers that they were living in Gaza. But according to international law, Gaza still is occupied because Israel controls all avenues. By land, sea, and air. It controls everything. Gaza is a box. The Palestinians are boxed in Gaza. They have no window to breathe because Israel controls all exits. So in this particular sense, as long as the Palestinians live in a state of siege, as long as there is military occupation, as long as the Palestinians are not allowed to basically have self-determination, as long as the Palestinians don't really see a light at the end of the tunnel. I fear that the Palestinians voted for Hamas 3 years ago. They voted Hamas as their political representative, not because they are irrational. No, they're not irrational. Because the alternatives, the choice was between Hamas and the dominant Fatah, Fatah being the ruling party of the Palestinian authorities. They voted for Hamas because it's less corrupt than Fatah. They voted for Hamas because Hamas is standing up and saying, we will defend the Palestinian identity against Israeli military occupation. And this is why, if we are really genuine, if we are really serious about breaking the deadly cycle of death between the Palestinians and Israelis, if we are serious about stopping the shedding of Jewish and Palestinian blood, not just Palestinian blood, we must really work very hard, all of us, in order to basically bring about a peaceful settlement whereby Israel will have security, and it has the right to have security, and the Palestinians have their legitimate interest of having home, a viable state whereby they can call home.
Mm-hmm. And that's the light that they would like to see that you just mentioned? That's the light?
Absolutely. That's exactly the light. And here, again, if we listen and if we read the dominant narrative in the United States, if you see what's being read, is that it's somehow the Palestinians are the impediment, the obstacle to the peace process. How many Americans, how many of our fellow Americans know that the entire Arab world, including the so-called radical states of Libya and Syria and Sudan, are on the record in 2002 saying we would like to offer Israel complete peace, that is, Israel would be integrated into the peace process, into the regional order, if Israel were to pull out of occupied Arab territories. All the Arab states, and in fact Hamas in the last year or so, has come closer to the consensus in the Arab world. That is, you have consensus in the Arab world that basically peace for land, the idea peace for land. In fact, and this is, it might sound irrational to you and to your listeners, really irrational. In fact, the only two powers that oppose this consensus about a comprehensive peace settlement are Israel and the United States. Do you believe it? I mean, if I tell you that Israel and the United States are the two powers in the region, in the world, basically, that opposing the international consensus that has emerged in the Middle East and Europe and the international community, that is, Israel would be integrated into the region if Israel just basically pull out of Palestinian territories and Syrian territories.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that Israel and the United States are saying no to that?
Absolutely. But because, I mean, not because the United States does not really want a peace. That's not the question. Because Israel has a veto over any peace initiative on the Middle East. As simple as that, Catherine. Mm-hmm. That is, no American official so far, we have to wait and see what the next, no American official, not even the U.S. president, would be able or willing or dare to offer a peace initiative unless somehow the Israelis okay this particular initiative.
Right.
And even though there are many voices in Israel, in fact, Israel is a very, inside Israel internal, there is a democratic process, a major debate about the peace process, and more Israeli voices, some of the top senior Israeli voices are saying, let's grab the so-called 2002 peace initiative advanced by the entire Arab world and basically have peace and pull out of Arab territories. But the irony is, just another footnote here, I know, look at the top leadership now in Israel. You have the Prime Minister Olmert, you have the Defense Minister Barak, and you have Livni, the Foreign Minister. The three top, and the President, of course, Peres, the four top Israeli leaders are on record saying that the only way for Israel out, the only way, is to accept the so-called the comprehensive peace initiative put on the table by the Arab League in 2002 in Beirut. Mm-hmm. They're on record a few months ago, and yet it's the same leadership that's waging an insane and unnecessary war in Gaza against not just Hamas. I mean, if it was a war against Hamas, one would have basically, we can debate the question. I would argue at least 50% of those killed are basically Palestinian children and women and non-combatants. And this is a tragedy. It's really a tragedy, I would argue, not just for the Palestinians. It's a tragedy for Israel and tragedy for American foreign policy.
Yes, it is. It's a tragedy to see those pictures, Fawaz. It stays with you. It's horrible.
It really is. You know, I mean, look at us now. I mean, this is not about really pinning blame. That's not the question. I mean, I think when I say, I mean, all of us, we must really work hard to stop the shedding of Jewish and Palestinian blood. It's been going on, Catherine, since 1947. Mm-hmm. 1947. Tens of thousands of Palestinians and Israelis and Arabs have been killed. You have 4 million Palestinians who are refugees, 4 million Palestinians who live basically in exile. And here, now we have an opportunity because a sea change. As a student of the Arab world, I am, and I challenge anyone who basically does, this is a sea change has taken place in the Arab world, that is, a consensus exists in the Arab world that Israel should and could be integrated into the regional, the social fabric in the region, as long as Israel accepts the international consensus. What the international consensus is that Israel must pull out of occupied Palestinian territories, that is, the West Bank and Gaza. Even though Israel pulled out of Gaza, Israel, under using international law, Syrian occupation of Gaza, because basically it controls all avenues to Gaza and, of course, pull out of occupied East Jerusalem. I mean, I'm hoping, and I do hope and pray, that the next president, the president of the United States, Barack Obama, would really invest precious political capital, as he just suggested last weekend, in order to help Palestinians and Israelis broker a peace settlement and put an end to this deadly embrace between the two people.
We pause for just a moment and we'll return and start taking phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Fawaz Jurjis is our guest this hour, and Fawaz has been with us many times before. He holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. He's the author of two recently acclaimed books, Journey of the Jihadist, Inside Muslim Militancy, and The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global. He has just returned from the Middle East and witnessed and has written about Israel's assault on Gaza and how it is radicalizing mainstream Muslim opinion, shown endlessly on Arab and Muslim television stations. The massive killing of civilians is fueling rage against Israel and its superpower patron, the United States, among mainstream and moderate voices who previously believed in coexistence with the Jewish state. Now they're questioning their basic assumptions and raising doubts about Israel's future integration into the region. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to send one, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now for Fawaz Jurjis, starting with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike, you're on the air.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Go right ahead, Mike. Well, we don't know what happened to Mike. So let's go to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi.
Hello. The United States would condemn any other nation if it acted like Israel in Gaza. Can you explain why the Israeli lobby wields so much power over the U.S. government?
Did you hear that, Fawaz?
Yes, I did. I mean, I mentioned earlier, Catherine, that Israel almost exercises a veto. And I'm not just suggesting that. I mean, American officials have made it very clear that when it comes to American foreign policy in the Middle East, Israel does exercise a veto. And this really brings us to the American political system and the constraints that the American political system basically have on the ability of an American president and the political leadership to basically take initiatives on the Middle Eastern peace process. And yes, I think in many ways that the irony here is that when we say the Israel's lobby, I'm one of those people who basically like to believe that the Israel lobby does not really reflect the broad interests of either Israel or even the Jewish community in the United States here. In fact, I am one of those voices who would like to see more Jewish voices participating in the American political process, because you have a tiny group of well-organized, almost Likud-like elements who basically would like us to believe that they speak for the American Jewish community and Israel as well. And that's why it's my hope that more Jewish voices, more progressive Jewish voices, would raise, basically come into the political process and try to counterbalance the preponderant influence of the Likud faction within the lobby itself. And in this particular sense, I think this is requires it's hard work, it's a long-term process. But at the same time, I like to believe that the lobby is very powerful, but if you have the political will, if you have the moral courage, I think American leaders could do a great deal. And I like to believe that the U.S. President Barack Obama could basically transform American foreign policy, not by basically neglecting Israeli interests. That's not the question. No one, Catherine, here is suggesting that the United States should not support Israel. But I think the United States should have the independence, the tactical and strategic independence. The United States should have the right and the ability and the will to tell Israel that when Israel is wrong, enough is enough. When the United States basically sees Israel basically using brutal and disproportionate use of violence, as it has been doing in Gaza, when the number of civilian casualties, almost now more than 500 civilians and almost more than 2,000 civilians are being injured, I think the United States, and here we're talking about American money and arms, when I say that the assault in Gaza is antagonizing Muslim public opinion against Israel and the United States, because the Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims and world public opinion is seeing basically the U.S. arsenal, the United States provides Israel with more than $3.1 billion a year in military and economic aid. The world is seeing the American arsenal used by Israel to kill Palestinians, not only Hamas, but civilians. And there is not only a moral responsibility on the United States, but also a political and practical responsibility to tell Israel, enough is enough. You are violating international law. You are committing war crimes against civilian population. I think it's in our own vital interest to do so.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of the hearing yesterday, Senator Clinton's hearing, in which she said she tended to revitalize the mission of diplomacy in American foreign policy, calling for, I'm not sure what this means, smart power strategy in the Middle East, and implicitly criticizing the Bush administration, she did, for having downgraded the role of arms control. When you hear smart power strategy, does that bring to mind a definite plan of action?
What it tells me, and I am hopeful, is that diplomacy will be the vanguard of American foreign policy, as opposed to hyper-militarism that has been the case in the last 8 years. Let's remember that the Bush administration criminally neglected the Palestinian-Israeli peace process for the first 6 years of its tenure. 6 years neglect, total neglect, and basically focus on the so-called war on terrorism, the global war on terrorism. In this particular sense, I'm very hopeful, and even President-elect Barack Obama over the weekend, he said on day one, Barack Obama will invest the prestige of his office in order to push the Palestinians and the Israelis into the negotiating table. He made it very clear that this is a high priority. We still don't know the details of this particular strategy. We know the vision. We don't know the details. And, Catherine, if you look at the lineup of his foreign policy team on the Middle East, I'm sorry to say, it's not very promising at all. The same people the same names, the same faces, the same failed policies since the Clinton administration are in charge of the American policy on the Middle East and Iran. My hope is that Barack Obama's vision will guide the policy and the ship of the state in the next 4 years. This is my hope, but it remains a hope before we see concrete initiatives and policies.
Hmm. So he's bringing along some of the same people who advised Clinton.
Clinton and Bush, the same, exactly the same people, Catherine. I'm literally speaking. It's the same names, the same people who basically failed to deliver in the last, basically, in the last two administrations. Both the Clinton are basically now in charge of the Obama foreign policy, in particular on the Middle East. There's not even a single voice. And here I underline a single voice outside of this particular elite, a group that has been in charge of American foreign policy. And this is why it's very disheartening. Because on the one hand, most of us believe that Barack Obama is genuine. Barack Obama would like to bring about change in American foreign policy. The question is, how could his vision be translated into concrete currency? Mm-hmm. When his advisors and Hillary Clinton advisors basically would be telling him what options, what scenarios, what analysis basically is involved in making and constructing American foreign policy to the Middle East. And that's why Barack Obama's vision is very important, because the truth is his vision will either guide this particular team or basically be corrupted and diverted from what we would like this vision to bring. And when we say this vision, we're not asking for radical shift or transformation, Catherine. Please understand, and I want your listeners to understand, we're not asking for the moon. We are asking basically for Barack Obama's vision to basically accept and act on the international consensus that has emerged in the international community over the last 10 years. That is a comprehensive peace settlement that provides Israel with security and help the Palestinians establish their viable state. I think that's all we're asking for. That's not really the moon. It's basically, it serves the interests of both Israel and its neighbors, but more importantly for me as an American, it serves the vital interest of the United States. And I expect and I hope that the President of the United States basically acts in order to protect and preserve and maintain American vital interests against the whims and the ideological inclinations of any group in the United States and abroad.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, okay. Am I on now?
Yes, you are, Mike.
Okay, because I was on before and then I got cut off, I guess. I understand your guest's point, and I hear the passion in his voice, but I think we're getting an awfully lopsided presentation. I have a couple of questions for him, and you know, he's been on the soapbox now for 45 minutes, so please give me a chance for a rebuttal. One question that I would ask him is, it's very curious Hezbollah's reaction to what's going on in Gaza. You know, there have been some missiles launched from Lebanon into northern Israel, and Hezbollah is kind of begging off, saying, hey, we've got nothing to do with that. That's a very curious reaction, number one. Number two, the fact of the matter is when Israel pulled out of Gaza, they opened up the borders. They opened up the borders for free transit of commerce, and almost immediately, there were suicide bombers all over the place. So I can, you know, anybody can understand Israel's reaction to that. The fact of the matter is that the Palestinians voted in Hamas, so they're suffering the consequences of the government that they elected. Final point. If something like that happened in this hemisphere, let's say Mexico started to lob, you know, missiles into San Diego, I guarantee you that our reaction in the first 8 seconds.
You're going to continue that?
Please go ahead, Mike.
You there, Mike? No, your phone is just... But we can surmise what he's going to say from that, Fawaz.
Three questions. Let me answer the three questions. And, of course, I am advancing a particular narrative that basically differs dramatically from the mainstream narrative that we hear on a daily basis, Catherine. I hope that's I mean, that's we're seeking a broader debate on the Middle East. Point one, I think there's a real danger that if the conflict continues in Gaza, that basically we might witness a broader conflict in the region. I could easily envision a scenario whereby Hezbollah and other groups basically become involved, in particular if Israel goes for the overkill, as it has been doing in Gaza. I'm really, really worried about a broader conflict in the region whereby Hezbollah and Syria and Iran and all the Palestinian factions become involved in this conflict. Because, as I said, what the Israel's assault on Gaza has done is to really radicalize and militarize and create a great deal of anger and rage in the region. Secondly, on the missiles, on the various missiles we have witnessed twice, missiles have been fired from southern Lebanon. Mike, I want you to know, and this is again an empirical fact, Israel has said it does not believe that Hezbollah fired the missiles against Israel. Israel has said it believes Hezbollah has not fired. Those are very tiny Palestinian groups who basically live and function in southern Lebanon. If Israel says that Hezbollah has not fired the missiles, and Hezbollah says it has not fired the missiles, I think, I hope that we agree on this. It's not Hezbollah that has fired the missile. Point one. Point two, yes, absolutely. Hamas fires rocket homemade projectiles and rocket against Israel. The question, as President-elect Barack Obama said, that Israel has the right to defend itself. Absolutely. But the question that all of us don't ask, Catherine, and for Mike, does Israel have the right to starve and suffocate the Palestinians? Does Israel have the right to basically starve the Palestinians and squeeze them almost to death in the last 3 years? After the Palestinians basically voted Hamas as their government, as their dominant government. The question is not whether why Hamas has been firing rockets. Absolutely. Israel has the right to defend itself. But does Israel have the right to violate international law and starve the Palestinian and squeeze the Palestinian and violate the humanity of the Palestinian? Point two, Israel has the right to defend its population. Absolutely. But does Israel have the right under international law to basically use brutal and disproportionate use of force against the civilians as it has been doing in the last 18 days or so? Again, the UN is very clear on the record. Israel appears to have violated international law and committed war crimes. Again, Mike did not listen to what I said. I said the reason why it's Hamas is not my choice. Hamas is a dead end in the way I see it, in terms of providing a vision for the Palestinians. The question what we need to understand as citizens, not as analysts, is that why would the Palestinians choose Hamas? The Palestinians have voted for Hamas not because they're irrational, I would argue, but because rational. Hamas is not as corrupt as Fatah. Hamas is the only alternative that defies Israeli military occupation. Hamas basically tells the Palestinians, I would defend you, I would stand up to military occupation, back to square one. The question, again, not to pin the blame on and we should, because you have, but how do we find a way out of this deadly embrace? Is boycotting the Palestinians, is suffocating the Palestinians, squeezing the Palestinians, military occupation of the Palestinians the way to go? Or a new vision called political engagement. Let's try, as President Carter has been saying for the last 2 years, let's try and see whether Hamas can evolve, would evolve. I would argue, instead of looking at Hamas as an evil-like organization, Hamas is a social movement. You have multiple perspectives within Hamas. You have, yes, the terrorist wing. I agree. And this has done a lot of damage to the moral compass of the Palestinians, but you also have a political apparatus. You have radical views, you have mainstream views, and I would argue, and I could be wrong on this, Hamas has been evolving in the last year. In fact, Hamas was coming almost to accept the international consensus, has called for a truce with Israel for almost 20, 30, 50 years. Instead of using hyper-militarism, instead of trying to so-called dominate the Palestinians and try to really force them to accept our will, as Israel has been doing, let's try something else. And I do hope that the United States, in this particular case, because we're not just a bystander here, America's political and military influence is involved in this particular conflict. At least that's how it is. Our money, our arms, and our support for Israel. That's why we have not just a moral right, we have a political responsibility to play a balanced role in trying to tell the Israelis enough is enough and try to basically engage with the Palestinians in order to convince them that there is a light at the end of the tunnel and marginalize the militants and the terrorist-leaning elements within the Palestinian population.
Mm-hmm. We've been wondering about how this may spread, Fawaz. There have been reports that the Iranian Ayatollah had gathered tens of thousands of people to go to help in the Hamas fight. And then a week later said, no, maybe you shouldn't do that. Do you know what's going on there, what Iran wants to do in this?
Well, I mean, I think, again, Catherine, regardless of how this particular war ends, I mean, I think there is no military solution to this war, as I suggested. Israel is trying to kill as many Palestinians as possible. I mean, what I mean, in the eyes, Hamas, they want to, I mean, they have destroyed Gaza. Gaza now, I mean, the damage, I don't know if you've seen it, Catherine, if your listeners, they're trying to kill as many Hamas fighters and militants as possible. Mm-hmm. This is basically, again, Israel and the United States are handing another sweet victory to Iran. In the same way that the war against Hezbollah in the summer of 2006 handed Iran a sweet victory, this war is how this war is handing a sweet victory to Iran. I mean, you have pro-Western moderate Arab regimes now are being blamed by their population for collusion with Israel against Gaza. Iran is seen as carrying the torch, the banner of resistance to Israeli and American policies in the region. And that's why Iran and Hezbollah are the main beneficiaries of this. In fact, and this is a critical question, really. In fact, the losers in this particular conflict are what I call not only Israel and the U.S., but also the pro-Western moderate Arab regimes, who basically are on the record blaming Hamas for the current crisis. And the winners, ultimately the winners, would be the so-called resistance front led by Iran and Syria. But I'm worried about, I said earlier, I'm worried about this particular conflict expanding, because I could easily envision a scenario whereby Hezbollah plunges into this conflict, even though in my recent travel, I interviewed some Hamas leaders, and they said they are fully aware of the risks of involvement in this particular conflict, even though they are on record saying that they won't get involved in this particular fight. I could easily envision a scenario whereby Hezbollah and Syria and Iran become directly involved, and here you have a region-wide conflict. The United States itself could find itself drawn into this large conflict if the situation in Gaza escalates, if Israel does not accept the UN security ceasefire that was basically has been in place since last week.
We're going to pause for just a moment and return and take more phone calls. Fawaz Yurjis is our guest. He has just returned from a research trip to the Middle East and has written about his findings and his concerns. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. His special interests include Islam and the political process, Islamist and jihadist movements, Arab politics, Muslim politics, state and society in the Middle East, American foreign policy toward the Muslim world, the modern history of the Middle East, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the history of conflict, diplomacy and foreign policy, and historical sociology. He has taught at a number of places, Oxford, Harvard, and Columbia, and as a research scholar at Princeton for 2 years. So, two more phone calls in a moment, and we will also welcome emails if you'd like to send them. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now for Fawaz and to Charlie or Chalky from Waukesha. Hello.
Hi, it's a Chokri, actually.
Chokri.
And, yeah, I would like to thank you for the program. And sadly, I have to point out that it took 1,000 dead people to have a clear situation depicted what's going on in Gaza. My question for your guest is, do you think that Hillary Clinton, in her ties with the Jewish lobby and AIPAC, that will change what has been known so far? And other, the other question is preventing Al Jazeera English to broadcast on the American TV network would help the American people understand really what's going on in the Middle East? And also, and finally, why some scholars which are which want to build bridges between the two cultures? Here, and I'm thinking about Tariq Ramadan, who is who was an advisor of the British Prime Minister Tony Blair, that the scholar wasn't allowed to come to the U.S. and teach at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much, and I take my answer of the year. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
I think there are three questions. The first question about Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton is perceived. There was a bit of disappointment, well, much disappointment in the Middle East when President-elect Obama selected Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State, because she is seen in the region as having very strong views, pro-Israel views. My take is different. I think Hillary Clinton shares the same views as Barack Obama in terms of foreign policy. And I think Hillary is a team player. Hillary is a very intelligent human being. She's not an ideologue. And I would argue whatever Obama and his team decide, I think Hillary will basically play as part of the team. And I think she knows better. She was there. She knows the players themselves. And Bill Clinton played a key role in trying to bridge the gap between the Palestinians and the Israelis, even though he failed because he came to it at the end of his administration. So I'm really, I think that Hillary is not as negative as people in the region, because in the people in the region think that any statement that because she has made strong statements in support of Israel, well, 99% of American politicians feel the same way about Israel, for a variety of reasons. So point two, I think the caller talks about really information and talks about the debate in the United States. I mean, Catherine, let's be blunt about it. How many NPR stations would have a particular perspective? And even NPR is one of the most inclusive and one of the most democratic, I would say, news outlet in the United States. It's really a breath of fresh air. But our mainstream media do not really allow a broader debate on the Middle East. While there is a broader debate in Israel itself, really it's one of the most refreshing countries when it comes to the debate on the Middle East, that is Israel. While in the United States here, the mainstream media is basically reluctant to really broaden the debate on Israel and the Palestinians to have a democratic, a more democratic discussion on the region. Thirdly, in this particular sense, I think having Al Jazeera English, because as you know, the U.S. government has not has put some blocks before Al Jazeera English or Al Jazeera International to broadcast in the United States. I think that would be wonderful. It would be wonderful for the American people. I think the American people are intelligent enough. They could make up their own mind. Let us compete. Let ideas clash. Let's see whether we can come to a particular synthesis about this conflict. Broadening the debate is good. It's good for everyone. After all, the United States is one of the most powerful democracies in the world. Mm-hmm. Are we afraid of ideas? And the gentleman, the caller, mentioned the case of Tariq Ramadan. Tariq Ramadan is a European, is a Muslim European intellectual who basically was hired by the University of Notre Dame. He was hired as a professor to teach Islamic history and Islamic culture, and the Homeland Security in the United States, the Department of Homeland Security, would not give him a visa to come and live in the United States. He now lives in London, and as the gentleman said, he advises the Prime Minister, and he might be moving to Oxford. And this tells you a great deal about what has happened to the United States since 9/11, that the debate has shrunk instead of really, and this is all because of the politics of fear. The politics of fear and the politics of stereotypes. And I think in this particular sense, the broader the debate, the greater the debate, the more democratic the debate, the better all of us are. We can make up our mind and influence the political process.
Yes. Fawaz, always a great pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's my pleasure, Catherine. Take care.
Yes, you too. Fawaz Jirjis just returned from another research trip to the Middle East and talking with us about that trip and his deep thoughts about what to do concerning the Middle East, what to do concerning, at the moment, Israel and Hamas. He holds the Christian Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. And he earned his doctorate from Oxford University, an MA from the London School of Economics and Political Science. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up and return with more Wednesday Conversation on the Ideas Network.